Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why you can't get hemp products like intoxicating vapes and gummies in Arizona anymore.
And if tackle football is too dangerous for girls to play, why do we still let boys play it?
But first, new research finds civics teachers across the country say in large part they are uncomfortable teaching civics and are unprepared to do so. The survey from the Sandra Day O'Connor Institute finds more than three quarters of respondents said they'd avoided certain topics or self-censored because they were afraid of backlash. But there are other reasons they cited as primary challenges to teaching civics, including a lack of time in the curriculum, insufficient training, and lack of support from school administration. Liam Julian is Vice President for Programs and Public Policy at the Sandra Day O'Connor Institute. He joins me to talk more about this study. And Liam, first off, what stands out to you about these findings?
Well, I think what stands out to us the most is probably the sort of broad finding that teachers who teach civics are not particularly comfortable doing it. And there's a variety of reasons why they're uncomfortable. But that in and of itself, that finding that civics teachers are uncomfortable teaching civics is somewhat startling. If we polled math teachers or science teachers and found that huge majorities of them were not comfortable teaching geometry or chemistry, I think we would all be astounded by that finding. But that's unfortunately the case with civics today.
Yeah. Well, so let's talk about some of those reasons. And I think some of them maybe are perhaps a little more obvious than others. And I'd like to start with the fact that, you know, some of these topics can be somewhat controversial. They can be debatable. They can maybe, you know, they don't have a lot of guidance from their district or their school, or in some cases, as you found, the state itself about what they can and can't say. How prevalent is that, that teachers, like, they kind of just don't want to wade into some of these hot button topics?
Well, it's quite prevalent, and all the reasons you described are correct. It starts at the state level, where you have state standards that are sometimes clear, but more often than not are vague. When we surveyed teachers, not even 15% of them said that they had received clear guidance from their district about what they could or could not teach. So just think about that, not even 15%. And then you compound all that with the fact that in today's environment, teachers are hyper aware that one misstep can really lead to some pretty serious professional and personal consequences. And so when you add all that up, it becomes sort of a chilling environment for teaching civics.
Did you find that, or did teachers talk about maybe trying to structure their lessons to keep it away from sort of current events and maybe some of those, you know, topics that can be controversial? I mean, I'm wondering, like, if you're just talking about like the makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court or the three branches of government or what the, you know, Bill of Rights says, I would think it would be kind of hard to find a lot of controversy, a lot of sort of potential landmines in those areas.
Yeah, that's correct. And when we talked to civics teachers, a lot of them did say that they sort of focused more on teaching that kind of content, the sort of how the government is structured. That's incredibly important, and students need to know that. But the issue is that in a civics class, you really want to be going beyond that to sort of have those discussions about how that works in practice. You want to be having discussions where students are learning about the tensions in our government, the tensions that come with having a country where we need to find compromise to get things done and how hard that can be. Those are the kind of conversations that are happening less and less in these classrooms. So we're getting civics, but we're getting, in many cases, a watered down version of it that does a disservice to students.
Is there a way to teach those kinds of tensions without potentially getting teachers in trouble or bringing up issues that, you know, some students or their parents might find super objectionable?
Yeah, I think there are. And, you know, we surveyed experienced civics teachers, and though they, huge majorities of even those experienced teachers told us that it was difficult to teach civics today, they also shared with us some of the strategies that they use in their classrooms. One that seemed to be common among experienced teachers and also effective was grounding those discussions in founding documents, in primary sources. And this accomplishes a number of things, but one thing is that it just sort of lowers the temperature. If you're talking about current issues and you just dive right in, those discussions can quickly get sort of personal and heated. But when you frame those sort of current issues in terms of, quite frankly, topics that we've been discussing in this country for hundreds of years and that the founders themselves were wrestling with, then it you have a different atmosphere for having a conversation. You also teach students the importance of grounding their opinions in evidence.
One of the other reasons that you found that teachers feel uncomfortable teaching civics is that it seems like they don't necessarily, some of them know civics all that well. And I guess going back to what you said about, you know, math teachers and science teachers, like if there was some percentage of math teachers who said they weren't prepared to teach geometry or algebra, that would be a really big deal. It seems like it's maybe equally a big deal if civics teachers aren't feeling particularly prepared to teach civics.
Yeah, and this is so important, and I'm glad that you're bringing it up. You have to keep in mind, too, that these teachers, most of them are, you would say, millennials or Gen X. They did not themselves have a robust civics education in their own K-12 careers. So you could have a situation where a teacher never had a civics class. And then in their sort of training to become teachers, what we heard from teachers and the surveys that we conducted is they didn't get a lot of civics content there either. And so you have a social studies teacher who is tasked with teaching a class on government, and they themselves may never have had a class on government. So that's a problem.
Well, so it seems like sort of the overarching message here is that teachers need more, right? They need more guidance from either the state government or from their school leaders or school district officials about what they can and can't do and can and can't say. And they need more content knowledge from whoever is doing the training about getting them up to speed so they feel comfortable teaching these subjects. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, you got it. So I think it's three things. It's preparation, guidance, and support. And so the preparation element is what you mentioned about content knowledge. They need to be trained in civics content, and they also need to be trained in how to lead conversations around controversial issues. Guidance needs to come in the form of clear state standards, clear guidance from district and school leaders about what can and cannot be taught, the ways in which it can and cannot be taught. And then support needs to come from those leaders as well. What that looks like is if a teacher is teaching civics in a responsible way, that's going to be supported, that teacher is going to be backed, and that type of teaching is expected.
All right. That is Liam Julian, Vice President for Programs and Public Policy with the Sandra Day O'Connor Institute. Liam, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Mark.
We all know you can get marijuana products at cannabis dispensaries all over the state today. But for a while there, you could get other products that get you high at your local convenience store. They were hemp products like gummies, vape pens, seltzer drinks, prepackaged brownies, even chocolate bars. They're often labeled as THC blends, and they contain other strains of psychoactive ingredients like the Delta 9 THC. But until recently, they were unregulated in Arizona and easy to get. That is, until Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays cracked down on these products, declared them illegal in our state, and forced stores to take them off the shelves. Now the hemp industry is suing and trying to convince a judge to let them put the THC-infused products back on the shelves in Arizona while the lawsuit plays out. Ray Stern with the Arizona Republic joined me to explain where it all stands and what's next, beginning with the difference between these hemp products and other marijuana products you'd find in a licensed dispensary.
It's kind of a regulation landscape situation. The hemp products and hemp itself is the same exact plant that is used in marijuana.
Okay.
And so hemp and marijuana, essentially, they both come from a plant called cannabis sativa. And hemp, by federal law, can't contain more than 0.3% of THC, Delta 9 THC in particular. And this is the psychoactive ingredient that gets people high. And Delta 9 is the typical type of THC that gets people high because it's naturally occurring in marijuana.
Okay.
And with hemp, you can actually extract the very small amount of THC and concentrate it.
Okay. So if you're buying these kind of hemp products, what are we talking about? Like, this is something that will get you as high as something in a cannabis dispensary.
That's right. If the label is correct, which isn't always the case, and it says Delta 9 THC and 100 milligrams, it is essentially the same product that you would get at a dispensary with a 100 milligram marijuana THC product. I guess you could, you know, if you could compare them, it would get you exactly as high.
Man. Okay. So before the AG crackdown, where could you get these? Like, these were just available, you know, at your convenience store at a gas station?
Right. Because there's confusion, you could say, over the legal situation, there's like two realms where you can find these products. The marijuana products, of course, are at the dispensaries. Voters in Arizona legalized that with medical marijuana 2010, and then for recreational, anyone 21 or over in 2020. Meanwhile, in the background, there's this thing called the 2018 Farm Bill. Mm-hmm. And it's just so ironic that marijuana remains federally illegal. And yet it's, you know, obviously proliferated across about half the states because of states' rights and the states like Arizona that have decided that marijuana will be legal in these states. And then you have the states like Arizona that declared that hemp products with THC are illegal, but those are legal federally.
So it's backwards,
yeah, totally
yes.
Backwards, totally confusing. But there's this 2018 Farm Bill, which controls a lot of the agriculture policies in the United States, and it has a provision on hemp. And in 2018, there was part added that basically said that the extracts for these hemp products are allowed. And, you know, the light bulbs went on in a lot of entrepreneurs' minds at that point. And they're like, wow, we could sell Delta 9 THC, Delta 8 THC, which is sometimes called weed light. And so then these products began to be sold in places that were other than dispensaries and allowed a different consumer often to get them.
Whether a younger consumer often.
Younger consumer sometimes because there, even though there's no official age range for this, people kind of understood that 18, you know, if you're selling it to someone under 18, that could be a problem. So I think that people 18 to 21 enjoyed these products. And then also in states that do not have legal marijuana, like Texas, these kind of smoke shop hemp products have really proliferated there.
Interesting. Okay. So some people have called this basically a loophole in that farm bill in which these kind of products were allowed to be sold. But our attorney general here in Arizona found out about this and said, no, this is not legal under the Arizona statute. What's her argument?
Well, the argument is that it's unregulated and that voters basically created a regulated environment for marijuana. Then you have this product that's basically the same as marijuana, but it's not sold in dispensaries. Nobody knows for sure. People are checking age IDs. There's a testing requirement in the marijuana law that requires marijuana to be tested for not only potency, but contaminants like heavy metals or pesticides. And nobody knows if that's being done on the hemp products. Some hemp manufacturers say they're doing it, but it's not checked at all.
Mm-hmm.
So there's just this unregulated landscape. And then also the marijuana industry in Arizona, they hate this because they're not seeing the profits from the THC hemp products. They're being sold at smoke shops.
Right.
And they've lobbied against it. They've tried to defeat bills that would essentially regulate the hemp market, but also legalize it and make it allowed to be in, you know, the smoke shops and whatnot. Dispensary industry does not like that.
Right. Okay. So we saw the AG crack down and threaten fines, threaten raids on places that were selling these products in Arizona. Have we seen any of that happen?
I haven't heard of any raids yet, and I've asked every now and then because that would be interesting if that's going through. But I also haven't heard of the hemp sellers that are testing the system. Mm. The AG, Chris Mays, she said could have a fine of up to $20,000 per item that you're advertising for sale. Total Wine, for example, which is a national liquor company, they had an entire aisle full of these THC drinks that they were selling before the AG cracked down on it.
Okay.
So that would have been millions of dollars in fines. They closed all that up and they don't sell it now.
Okay. So no one's really testing that. But there is a lawsuit over this. Who's suing?
The Hemp Industry Trade Association of Arizona. You know, just to get a little bit of the background here, this started out as like a farming situation with the bill in Arizona that Doug Ducey signed, former governor, to allow industrial hemp.
Right.
And then the whole industry changed from like farming into these products that are sent here from other states. Often they're often not made here. They have the THC in them. Mm-hmm. And so the whole concept of it changed. But at the same time, these people are happy to be making money. They're making a lot of money. They're employing thousands of people. And so the hemp industry is saying, look, this actually has some legal, well, loopholes, or, you know, it's not loopholes from their point of view. It's legalities that they can sell this stuff.
On a federal level, yeah.
On a federal level. And so the crackdown obviously hurts the industry quite a bit. And they've tried to stop the crackdown. Unfortunately for them, they failed on the lower court level. And so now they're appealing to the appeals court in Arizona.
And it could very well end up at the state Supreme Court, it sounds like.
It could.
Yeah.
And the judge in the trial court case, Judge Randall Warner, they're trying to overturn his decision that basically we've got two laws in Arizona. There's the one for marijuana and there's the one for hemp. And these two are not compatible.
Right.
So if you're selling hemp and it's got THC in it, that has to be sold at a dispensary. The judge did, though, say that maybe more legislation is needed because it's all a bit confusing.
That leads me right to my next question, right? Like, we have seen efforts to regulate these products and to create some kind of regulation framework from the state legislature before. Has anything ever come to fruition?
It hasn't. Though last year, I think it got as close as, you know, it's come so far. Senator T.J. Shope, who originally was against the hemp products, and he's, or let's say that he's against the lack of regulation.
Right.
Well, now he had signed on to a bill that would have allowed just hemp beverages, like what Total Wine was selling. So that bill did get a little bit of support. Ultimately, it was not passed in the legislature. And I talked to Senator Shope recently. He said that he's still willing to look at that stuff, but he hasn't talked to anyone lately about it.
Okay, so we'll see what happens on that front. Ray, are these kinds of products allowed to be sold in other states around the country? What does the national landscape look like here?
Yeah, it varies completely. And so you'd see big differences, like in California. Gavin Newsom last year put out an emergency declaration for a hemp ban. And I understand that's been pretty effective. And the hemp THC products have been tamped down and they're doing enforcement there. In Texas, which does not have legal marijuana like California does,
right,
where the smoke shops have, you know, and the hemp products have proliferated there, the legislature has tried to ban them, but it hasn't worked out yet. A bill just recently died a few weeks ago. And so apparently hemp THC is still on the table in Texas.
All right. So still a patchwork and an interesting national landscape on this. That is the Arizona Republic's Ray Stern joining us with the latest on this story. Ray, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, one cow's dramatic escape and a life or death fight for freedom.
But first, there is a seismic shift taking place in the world of high school football. Tens of thousands of the athletes playing it are women, and they're playing a much safer version of the sport called flag football. The main difference between flag football and traditional football: in flag football, instead of tackling an opponent to halt their progress on the field, players grab a strip of fabric from their uniform. Flag football's popularity is exploding. In 2023, 500,000 girls aged 6 to 17 played flag football. That's an increase of 63% since 2019. It's an undeniably positive trend from a gender equity standpoint. But for gender studies scholar Michael Messner, the flag football phenomenon also raises a thorny question. If tackle football is too dangerous for girls to play, why do we still allow it for boys? Messner explored this question recently in a piece for the LA Times. He talked about it with our co-host, Sam Dingman.
You know, we know more and more about the dangers of playing tackle football now. I mean, there's just last week a study of 1988 NFL players, and those older men now have far higher levels of physical pain daily and cognitive problems than other men their age. And we also know that 3 years of playing tackle football doubles the chance of developing CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. So why do we ignore this with boys and men when we know the risks and we're saying girls and women shouldn't play this game?
In your piece, you go back pretty far in history in looking into to the answers to that, because you point out this is actually a very old debate. What should the role of tackle football be in young men's lives? And you take this all the way back to World War I.
Yeah, and even a little before that, in 1909, there was a lot of national debate about football because there are a lot of deaths on the field. There's spectator violence, other problems with football. And so a lot of universities were doing away with it. But then coming out of World War I, there was a lot of anxiety about what was considered kind of lack of physical toughness of a lot of the recruits that had been drafted into the army. And there were a lot of fears, and this is a recurring thing throughout US history, fears of kind of feminization of boys. Public schools are going to feminize boys, book learning, women teachers, modernity,
Yeah, these are active concerns among some on the right to this day.
that's exactly right. And so you see football reinstituted, and then by the middle of the century, the football hero really is at the center of the status system of American high schools. And I think in many ways that's still the case today. So, we've been through several decades of really positive development of thinking about girls and women's health, whether it's, eating disorders or breast cancer or sexual assault. And we've barely begun to think about the ways in which adherence to narrow conceptions of masculinity really raises risk factors for boys and men's health.
That was something that this piece brought up for me, is there is such an active conversation culturally at the moment about this idea of men allegedly being ignored, their concerns not being listened to, and this notion that by returning to these older forms of masculinity, these more traditional interpretations of what it means, we can somehow make up for that. And your piece, it struck me, was making a more meaningful argument, which is that yes, the concerns of men and masculinity have not been looked at as closely in recent years, but we should be interrogating and deconstructing those old versions of it rather than just snapping back to them and assuming that will make men feel seen or cared for.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think one of the things that keeps us from doing that is the ways in which we have culturally elevated that kind of warrior masculinity, and the sort of collective identity and emotional investment is gigantic as well. I mean, football really sits at high school football really sits at the center of the way schools develop collective identity, communities and develop their identities. And there's this whole sort of ritual complex, homecoming celebrations.
Yes. Friday Night Lights. It's not
Yeah.
just the title of a show. It's a stand-in and a book. It's a stand-in for an entire community gathering ritual.
Yes, and that book, Friday Night Lights, I mean, the show was good, but the book, Friday Night Lights, is a pretty devastating read in a lot of ways in terms of looking straight at in the eye at the sort of community investment in football and what it does for the whole community, and their sense of who they are.
Yes.
So.
Well, just, extending this idea of the relationship between tackle football and male identity, it makes me think about the fact that it's not just sort of hardwired into the American male consciousness that playing football is not just a virtuous but kind of awesome thing to do, but it's also hardwired in that getting together on Sundays with your buddies and cooking food and drinking beer all day, existing on the periphery of tackle football, it's like the whole reason that a lot of men even have, not to overuse this word, but community at all.
That's absolutely right. And for both spectators and fans, and also for players, the research I did years ago for my first book called Power at Play, it was a life history interviews with men who are former athletes. And so many of them in their middle age years were physically broken. And then I'd ask them, would you do this again? And almost all of them said, yeah, absolutely, I would. And not because necessarily they loved the action or they loved the adulation. But the main thing they talked about was the connection they had with other guys. I've never had a sense of family like I had when I was on that team. And I think there's something about, and as you said, for men who are fans as well, there's something about the sort of poverty of men's relationships with each other that has to do with sometimes fears of being vulnerable. Sometimes it has to do with homophobia. And then we find these things like sports through which we can connect with each other and develop real connections with each other that are really meaningful.
Yeah, yeah. And I hope that, you know, what I said earlier didn't come across as minimizing, because I mean, I feel this sort of connection too in my own life. I mean, for me, it's baseball, but like, it strikes me that this is at the heart of why this editorial that you wrote is so provocative, because for men who have football at the center of their identities, whether it's as players or as fans, the idea of taking it away or even of changing it doesn't feel like a change to the rules of a sport. It feels like a change to the core relationships of your life.
That's exactly right. It's like, you know, ripping away something that has been so so foundational for connecting with other people. And I think, you know, when we think about boys and sort of the future of young people, it's really important to ask questions about, you know, what are the sort of opportunities that we're giving boys to learn to connect with other people in comfortable and intimate sorts of ways? Intimate meaning, you know, that you can be
yeah.
vulnerable with each other. Is there a range of ways that we can do this? And you know, some people, you know, find, you know, music to be a way to do this, and other people find other ways to do it. But the sort of cultural valuation of football in high schools and across the country, I think, is something that there's a powerful kind of gravitational pull to it for a lot of boys and men. And I think it's really important for us to rethink that.
Well, Michael Messner is Professor Emeritus of Sociology and Gender Studies at USC. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It was really a pleasure talking with you.
Making a wildlife film can take you to some fascinating places, from waiting weeks for an elk battle to getting inside of a snake hole or under a beaver dam. And our next guest specializes in just that. Ben Masters makes wildlife films, and his latest hits home. It's called The American Southwest, and it takes viewers on a trip down the Colorado River, tracing its history and confronting the impact of overuse. It's narrated by Indigenous actress and activist Quanah Chasing Horse.
Water is the divine force in this unforgiving landscape. It is the most essential and precious resource that has supported humanity for over 1,000 generations.
I spoke with Masters more about it.
So the American Southwest follows two storylines. One is the Colorado River's journey from its headwaters in the Rockies down to the Gulf of California. And then the other is our society's influence on the river and the wildlife, both good and bad. And I framed it that way because it was kind of a natural journey. Let's chronologically begin the film with how Native peoples utilized elk, and then, you know, how during colonization the elk were completely wiped out. But our society is also capable of these amazing wildlife recoveries and to show the elk recover, and then to kind of follow the river's journey through these different wildlife stories, whether it's a beaver creating wetlands or the salmon fly doing this ancient metamorphosis or condors flying through the Grand Canyon. And then along the way, we can see the river get dammed and diverted and canaled and used by cities and piped out of the basins and, you know, so thoroughly exhausted that this, you know, heartbeat of the Southwest is entirely consumed.
Yeah, that's what struck me about it, right? Because when I, as a journalist in the Southwest, talk about the Colorado River, it is almost always about the management of it, right? And this kind of debate, these tough negotiations that are going on between policymakers and Washington and the federal government and local leaders and all these interest groups and tribes who want a piece of the river and how they're going to shake that out, we still don't know. But your film looks at the river in such a different way in terms of water and the importance of it and the power of it in these kind of desert regions.
Yeah, the river should have water in it. I mean, I think everybody agrees to that, but we're just trapped in this antiquated river management system that's based off of values and infrastructure that's over 100 years old. And it's just in dire need of new management. I mean, the river should have water in it. And the thing that frustrates me is if there's truly a shortage of water in the Southwest, why is there hundreds of thousands of acre feet getting exported overseas in the form of alfalfa? That's like, by definition, a surplus.
I want to ask you, Ben, about how you shot this, right? And as you shoot wildlife films in general, right? Like, but you're underwater, you've got, it looks like, cameras inside snake holes, like you're in the air with birds, you're looking at teeny tiny insects. Like, there's such a craft to this, I'm sure. How do you shoot this stuff?
So we identified kind of the main storyline, and then we identified, all right, here's how we're going to shoot it. Here's what is going to be required. Here's the tools, the amount of time. And then the really fun part began of actually being in the field and spending, you know, 70 days waiting for the condor to fledge and take its first flight, right, or 3 weeks trying to get an epic fight with the elk during the rut,
yeah,
or doing, you know, speed dating with Mojave rattlesnakes, trying to find a match. Once we figured out how to film the behavior that we were doing with, which we relied very heavily on biologists and NGOs for that intel on how to get the behaviors. Once we identified that, then we were like, all right, what kind of gear do we need? How much time do we need to dedicate? And that was the fun part, was spending hundreds of days in the woods filming wildlife.
I'm sure it was hundreds of days, literally, for sure. Do you have any favorite moments you captured, favorite animals, favorite characters?
Oh, gosh, I think that getting some of the jaguar footage has to be right up there at the top moments of my life. I mean, getting to see borderlands jaguars, you know, in 8K on a 80-inch monitor and just looking at it like, holy smokes, that is a real life animal. That is the coolest thing I have ever seen.
Yeah, it is. Let me ask you about Quanah Chasing Horse as your narrator. I mean, she's an interesting figure in the indigenous communities across the country right now. Why choose her voice?
So I am a white guy from Amarillo, Texas. And I've always kind of wanted to partner with an indigenous group. And I was at a film festival, and there was a fellow by the name there called Dr. Lynn Nessifer, who started Natives Outdoors, and he was given a presentation on how to incorporate Native storylines into movies. And afterwards, I went and told him about this film that we were making, and that began an amazing collaboration with Natives Outdoors. They consulted on script, brought in a lot of their shooters. They're based there in Tucson, as well as bringing in Quanah Chasing Horse and having her narrate the film. In my opinion, I feel like Quanah delivered one of the most beautiful wildlife narration performances and possibly one of the most beautiful film narration performances. It's so good. And she just put so much heart and emotion into each of the lines. It was a real cool experience to work with her.
That's really cool. Let me ask you lastly, Ben, about, I guess, the point here. You talk about conservation. I think in the film, you call it a call to action, right? For conserving these wild areas, these wild animals, the river itself. How do you view film's role in that debate over conservation and what should be our priorities moving forward?
I mean, I feel like storytelling has almost become equally or more important than science and research. And that pains me to say that, because I feel like science and research and making informed decisions and bringing concrete data to policymakers is so critically important. But there's just, this isn't a surprise to anybody, there's just like people that don't understand how to read science, or they question it, or they think it's biased. And then there's also realities that a lot of science is way underfunded, or they're getting their funding cut. And I think that it's just really important to tell these stories and connect people in ways that's not data driven. But anybody that stood at the edge of the Grand Canyon, they know it's important. You know, anybody that lives in the Southwest that has seen the tracks of a jaguar in a sandy wash, they know that that mountain range is wilder and more wonderful because of that animal's presence. And I feel like films, they tap into that emotional connection to the land in a way that science and data just can't do. And it creates a love for one's home that I feel like taps into something really primal within people. And it creates this urge to do as much as we can to conserve it and to conserve its water.
We will leave it there. That is Ben Masters, director of the new film, The American Southwest. Ben, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. The United Nations General Assembly will get underway tomorrow in New York, and members will have no shortage of issues to discuss. With me for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones in London. And Rob, why is the gathering so significant this year?
Well, Mark, every year this is a big gathering. There are 193 members of the United Nations, and in most years, most of them will turn up at this meeting. This is the number one UN jamboree, if you like, and they will turn up and they'll talk about all manner of kind of global concerns, plans for the future, cooperation between nations and regions, and so on. So it's really quite important, and quite a lot usually comes out of it. This year is the 80th UN General Assembly, and it's, and the theme this year is Better Together, which is a bit ironic considering, you could argue, on the international scene, there's not much sign of togetherness. So we've just seen President Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, President Putin, the Russian leader, Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, only a few days ago walking and speaking together in Beijing and underlining their deep ties and how they want the world order to change and not be kind of Western dominated and so on. President Trump actually responded to that meeting by accusing all three of them of conspiring against the United States. Well, they might say that perhaps he's conspiring against them because he has been imposing tariffs, of course, on many, many countries around the world, in particular India, which was present at that meeting in Beijing, their leader, but also Brazil. So both of those countries have 50% tariffs imposed on them for all of their exports, or most of their exports, to the United States. So there's a sort of strong sense of division just as we come to this Better Together UN General Assembly. Now, the Assembly will have to focus this year on big stuff like what's going on in Israel, in particular in Gaza. We saw the shooting this morning in Jerusalem, which has killed at least six people. We've also seen that Israel has accepted Donald Trump's proposal for a ceasefire in Gaza, and Hamas has said it's ready to go to the negotiating table immediately to talk about this. There's still big gaps between them, but you know, that's a really in development today. So you can imagine that this will come up at the UN General Assembly. Also, the events in Ukraine, of course, because they've just seen a record Russian bombardment on Sunday morning, Sunday just gone, of around 820 drones and missiles hitting that country. That is a record. One of those actually hit one of the top government buildings in the capital, Kyiv, which we've not seen before. In part because it's so well defended. But, you know, these events are ongoing. President Trump has said he wants to talk to Vladimir Putin again in the coming days. He wants to gather European leaders again to talk about their response to Ukraine. So, you know, all of this is going on. So this UN General Assembly this year is going to be incredibly busy because there is quite simply just so much to talk about.
Yeah, it sure seems like it. So, Rob, tomorrow we'll see the inauguration of Africa's largest hydroelectric dam. It's happening in Ethiopia. Why is the BBC keeping an eye on this story?
Well, this is interesting because Ethiopia, as you say, is set to officially inaugurate Africa's largest hydroelectric dam. So this is built over the Blue Nile for $4.6 billion. It's called the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. And the people of Ethiopia are very proud about this. And not only are they proud about it, they're very pleased that it's arrived because many, many people in that country do not have electricity and they can't rely on electricity. But this dam is going to generate, or it claims that it will generate, more than 5,000 megawatts of electricity. Now, the problem is that it's been at the center of a diplomatic row between Addis Ababa, the capital of Ethiopia, and Egypt, and indeed Sudan, because those two countries, Egypt and Sudan, they worry about the essential water supplies that they rely on that could be impacted. And that's because the Blue Nile provides a great deal of the water that goes into the Nile River. It's slightly confusing. There's the Blue Nile, the White Nile, but both of them are actually tributaries into the Nile. And it's the Nile that Egypt in particular relies on for its irrigation and so on. So the concern, of course, in Egypt and Sudan is, well, what if Ethiopia were to restrict that water supply in some way? It would cause us, you know, extraordinary trouble. By the way, this is actually mirrored in China, interestingly, which is working on the largest hydroelectric dam project in the world in Tibet. And that is having a very similar impact on neighboring countries, India and Bangladesh, who both worry about their water supplies. But anyway, the inauguration of this dam happens this coming week, and that will be a very big moment for Ethiopia and indeed for Africa.
Yeah, sounds like it. All right, so Rob, finally, let's go to where you are in London, where there is some controversy about where the new Chinese embassy will be located. What's the story here?
Well, this is interesting. Some of your listeners may have visited London in times gone by, and they might have gone to Tower Bridge in London, which is a, you know, big tourist hotspot, mm-hmm. magnet for tourists. Well, just on the north bank of the River Thames there is a building, beautiful building, called the Royal Mint Court. And that was bought by the Chinese about 7 years ago. And it's, you know, a very beautiful building. And that is what the Chinese want to turn into a 20,000 meter. So what is that? About 60,000 foot square foot embassy. If they get the go-ahead for this, then that would be the largest embassy of any country in Europe. But the problem with it is that where it's located, it's very, very close to, if you like, the beating heart of Britain, certainly commercially and financially, and that's the City of London. And that's really the financial district where all the big banks are and everything else. And of course, they rely very much on things like fiber optics. And are those fiber optic cables are traveling anywhere near, perhaps even underneath that new embassy? Is there a security issue around this? The local council actually turned down the Chinese plans for this when they first submitted them. They've now resubmitted them, and the government, the British government, has taken over the assessment of these, and it's in this week, in this week coming, that we should see a step forward on whether the government's prepared to accept it or not. But what it really does is it really underlines the kind of lack of trust, if you like, between a G7 nation like Britain and China. Because in normal circumstances, you know, a country will do what it can to facilitate the building of an embassy of another country in its capital city. But in this case, Britain is raising all sorts of questions about the security of having a huge Chinese embassy bang in the middle of its capital. So we'll be watching that one this week.
That sounds really interesting. All right. That is the BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones in London. Rob, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. And finally, this morning, we bring you a story of daring, grit, and escape. An Arizona tale with the Western tropes of a lone hero, a standoff, and a search for justice.
2 weeks ago, a cow inexplicably escaped from a slaughterhouse in Santan Valley and started running and running. The show's Sativa Peterson caught up with Ruth Carter, a volunteer at Amy's Farm Animal Sanctuary, to find out more about this great escape.
A cow got loose from Miller's Processing Center. That's a business where people who own cattle have them killed so that they can be eaten. So this cow did not want to die. And so somehow she broke out of there and she took off. And she was literally running for her life in the Arizona heat, obviously not knowing where she was. People were putting up posts about her. She was photographed in front of a local middle school a little bit before noon. And then she was finally captured somewhere around 4 o'clock when she was found in a water hazard at a golf course. She ran over 3 miles in that time.
3 miles. And that's when the story took a turn. For the cow, scheduled to return to the processing center, she had a different fate awaiting her.
When it was shown that she was found and all the pieces were put together about, you know, who this cow was and where she came from, Amy saw that and said, this cow wants to live. You know, I want to save her. And so she reached out to Miller's processing plant and was connected with the owner of the cow.
So the cow's owner granted 24 hours to raise $2,500 for the cow's release. Otherwise, she would be processed. Around 5 o'clock that evening, the sanctuary put out a call to the community on Facebook. By 11 o'clock, enough money had been donated to save the bovine escapee.
Following day, around 4 o'clock, she was delivered to Amy's Farm Animal Sanctuary, where she will know nothing but love for the rest of her life. They have chickens, geese, ducks, goats, sheep, alpacas, cows, donkeys, a mule, pigs, mini horses, dogs, cats, rabbits. I feel like I'm forgetting something.
Wow. And now a new, very determined member.
Yes, a new member of the family who has a determination to live.
At the time of rescue, the cow still had a tag on her ear, which prompted Ruth to say, our animals at the farm have names, not numbers, and now this courageous cow has a name of her own.
We've batted around several names, and I will admit we do like our pun names. So the name that Amy decided on was Mootilda. I told you we love our pun names. We have a Muchacha, a Muthias, a Mona Lisa, and now Mootilda. But Mootilda was named after a female warrior named Matilda, who fought for her right to the throne, and she led an army and used her knowledge to succeed.
Mootilda is adjusting to sanctuary life, eating well and getting along with the other cows in the pen. We also hear she has a grassy pasture to graze, plenty of shade, high-quality hay and grains and snacks of bananas and melon and apples.
You can see photos of Mootilda's escape and new sanctuary life on our website, and you can follow Amy's Farm Animal Sanctuary on Facebook or Instagram. The farm offers cow-hugging tours, but we don't know if Mootilda will feel like hugs just yet.
We'll do it Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for being along. Hey, if you've ever wanted to see the show live, You know, if you've ever wanted to do that.
I bet this is something people want.
You see it live every day.
I hear it as well, yeah.
But if you've never seen it and want to, we are putting it on stage. I don't think any cows will be there, though.
It's
September 14th, this coming Sunday at Crescent Ballroom. Go to rsvp.kjzz.org for more info. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.